Orion Magazine hosts regular dialogues with writers, artists, activists, and thinkers about transforming ideas into action for people and planet. These events are free and open to all Orion readers and friends. Today we bring you another such conversation. Dialogues like this are made possible by your donations, so please go to orionmagazine.org/donate to support Orion in bringing readers, writers, and activists together in this way. Thank you.
Welcome to Orion's live event on Upping the Stakes with Derek Jensen. Thanks for joining us. This is Eric Hoffner, Outreach Coordinator for Orion Magazine. This live event is the latest in a series of monthly dialogues with authors, thinkers, and activists that inform us and inspire the entire Orion community. Last month, our guests were Wendell Berry and friends. If you missed this unique conversation on principled activism, head over to orionmagazine.org/audio-video to hear that. Remember to log in with your computer now if you haven't already done so to see the slideshow. We're going to refer to images now and then. If you prefer to just listen, why, that's fine too. Our next event is with Richard Louvre, David Sobel, and Camilla Rockwell on combating the deficit of nature in our lives on June 16th. Registration for that event will be posted soon at orionmagazine.org/news, so check back there. We're going to post the audio from today in case you want to hear it again or want to share it with a friend. Check the Orion Community webpage to find a link to that audio file when it becomes available later tomorrow, orionmagazine.org/community. After tonight's guest reads his essay on the tragic hero mindset, we'll open it up to your questions. Email a question for him to events@orionmagazine.org or use the chat box on the web interface to send a question at any time, but please keep it as brief as you can. I hope you'll consider supporting this conversation and others in the series by making a gift to Orion, which you can do at orionmagazine.org/donate. In fact, if you make a gift between now and Memorial Day, it'll be matched dollar for dollar by a group of generous Orion donors as part of our Spring Challenge campaign. But back to today, leading the discussion is Derek Jensen. Derek is the author of Thought to Exist in the Wild, Songs of the Dead, Deep Green Resistance, and many other books, including Endgame, portions of which have been made into a hard-hitting new documentary film called EndCIV. In 2008, he was named one of Utney Reader's 50 Visionaries Who Are Changing Your World. His Orion column is called Upping the Stakes, and it consistently generates a lively and sometimes heated discussion in the print magazine and on our website. His latest, which has just been posted to our site, is called To Live or Not to Live, and he's going to read that for us now. So thanks again so much for joining us, Derek, and the mic is now yours.
Well, thank you so much for having me. So I'll read this now. To Live or Not to Live. The danger of the tragic hero mindset. Have you ever noticed how many excuses we all find to not act in defense of the planet? Sure, we all have errands to run and emails to answer, and we all need downtime and your problems are so big, and insert your best excuse here. But lately I've been encountering a particularly frustrating excuse that a lot of people seem to be giving for not acting. They say it's too late. The various tipping points have been reached in terms of runaway global warming, that especially because of the lag time between carbon emissions and increased temperature, we're already doomed. So what's the point of fighting back? This pro-tragedian posturing infuriates me. What infuriates me even more is that this reasoning has become so familiar. I encounter it all the time. Literally the moment I finish typing the above, and I'm not making this up, I received an email that said, solutions are inadequate, futile, and too late. I wish people would admit this rather than scramble for last-ditch efforts. Just as people speak of peak oil and peak civilization, we're peak life. 3 billion years of cyanobacteria, 500 million years of increasingly complex life forms, and a cherry topping of 2 intelligent human beings. Humans are demonstrating that intelligent life is unsustainable, perhaps triggering the downward slope of life complexity and returning the planet to its microbial past. As I finished pasting that quote into this column, I received yet another such email. The notion that humans are the peak form of life and everyone else is just background leads to a sense of entitlement, which leads to atrocities against those who, or in this formulation, that, are seen as less than peak forms of life. And anyway, what kind of peak life form would knowingly degrade its land base and then throw up its hands when action is most needed to counteract construction? I'm not convinced that humans are particularly more intelligent than parrots, octopi, salmon, trees, rivers, stones, and so on. But even if you did believe that humans were more intelligent, it wouldn't alter the fact that the Tal Indians lived where I live now for 12,500 years and did so without destroying the place. I'd hate to try to make the argument that the Tal didn't destroy the land because they weren't intelligent enough to do so. But there's another point I want to make here, which has to do with the tragic posturing. In his book, The Comedy of Survival, Joseph Meeker points out that human cultures through the ages have created comedies, but only civilizations created the genre of the tragedy. In fact, you could easily say that tragedy is this culture's tragic flaw. A tragic flaw, you probably recall, is a flaw in the protagonist's character that brings him or her to ruin. The flaw could be indecision, hubris, jealousy, etc. The point is that the character is unable or unwilling to examine and overcome this flaw, and in my perspective at least, it is this, and not the flaw itself, that leads to the downfall. Tragedies presume inevitability, which presumes an inability to choose. As one definition puts it, tragic behavior assumes change is not possible and will defend this assumption to the death. I've always found classic tragedies such as Hamlet or Othello to be more frustrating than cathartic. I mean, if your behavior is leading you and those around you to ruin, why not just change your behavior? Why hold tight to a character flaw that's killing you and those you love? The tragic hero only becomes aware of his or her fatal flaw once it's too late. I'm far more interested in stopping the tragedy before it's too late than I am in feeling sorrow or empathy for those who cannot or will not change their destructive behavior. What's worse is that this human culture's tragic hero narrative, the flaw is nothing so ignoble as greed, lust, jealousy, or even indecision. Rather, the tragic flaw this culture ascribes to itself is intelligence. We're simply too smart to allow life on this planet to continue. And of course, we're unable to change, so there's nothing to be done. Cue the curtain, cue the tears, drop the curtain. I'm not interested. First, the premise that intelligence is behind the murder of the planet is both inaccurate and absurd. Second, the murder of the planet is a result of behaviors which can be changed and infrastructures which can be destroyed. There's nothing inevitable about it. Nor do I believe that global warming has reached a final tipping point. There are plenty of options to try first, like deindustrializing. People like James Lovelock, who predicts that by the end of the 21st century, billions of us will die and the few breeding pairs of people, who survive will be in the Arctic where the climate remains tolerable, are already acknowledging that this culture, if left unchecked, will essentially kill the planet. Well, if this culture will kill the planet, then it looks like it's time to roll up our sleeves and do what's necessary, not stick our heads in the sand. The best way to guarantee that it's too late is by saying it's too late and not acting to help the world as we know it survive, a world with goblin sharks and pencil fish where bats flutter by at night and butterflies and bumblebees light up the days. My friend, the great Dakota activist, Waz, once said, "That defeatist attitude makes me want to scream. The battles we're fighting are overwhelming, but we know things won't get better if we do nothing. Our only hope is enough people intervening and taking action, people willing to risk everything now so we all don't lose everything later. The only sense of empowerment I feel is by taking some kind of action, whether it's writing, working to undermine the existing structures, or sitting on the open prairie in December with a Dakota man trying to save our land base." She went on, If our actions will do nothing, why would anyone even want to live anymore? That kind of hopelessness in the defeatist sense means an embracing of victimage and complete powerlessness. Here the salmon have much to teach. Either they make it upriver to spawn or they die trying. If our actions make it so there's even a 0.001% chance that things will work out better for ourselves and the planet, then it is our moral duty to act and act and act before it's too late. Am I optimistic? Not in the slightest. Am I going to quit? Not in your fucking life.
Thanks, Derek. This particular essay is a great example of your columns, which constantly are challenging our readers to take their thinking on activism to a whole other level. Orion is known as a forum for ideas, and it's always sought to plant the stakes further out from the center with its ideas, but your stakes are definitely of the higher variety and are about really preventing our culture from killing the planet. Your 2009 essay, for example, Forget Shorter Showers, on how personal change alone can't create the kinds of change we need in order to really survive on the Earth, it's still the most commented article on our site. But this new piece, you attack complacency again, but from an interesting new vantage of personal empowerment and responsibility. It reminds me of Tim DeChristopher, who we had on our live web event last month, along with Wendell Berry. If you haven't heard of him, Tim is the climate justice activist who disrupted an illegal federal oil and gas auction in Utah by outbidding everyone else and without the intent to pay. He's now facing 10 years in jail, but the auction was nullified, and the oil and gas are going to stay in the ground because of his action. So my question for you is, how does this sort of modern-day monkey wrenching fit into your view of a principled activism that keeps us from destroying the planet?
Well, sometimes I get wrongly pegged as the violence guy, and that's kind of crazy because at every talk I give and in all the pieces that I write, I try to emphasize that we need it all, and I think we do need it all. I don't really care. I don't think it's important. It's not too important to me, and it's not too important, I don't think, to the salmon, exactly how the dams come down. What's important is they come down. There's five dams going to be removed on the Lower Klamath sometime within the next 10 years, I think, 10 to 15 years. And that's all because of deals reached between multiple states, corporations, and Indian nations. And that's great. And so I think, you know, the big distinction is not between those who want to do some sort of militant action, those who do not. The big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing. And I've mentioned this in one of my earlier columns for Orion. Earlier today, I was out wading in the pond, bringing in tadpole eggs, frog eggs, because the local frogs are disappearing. And on a global scale, of course, this doesn't do anything, but it's a little bit that helps. I don't want to say one thing about this, too, before we go to whatever the next question is, that is probably the smartest decision I ever made was when I was in my early 20s, or mid-20s, I realized I wasn't paying enough for gas. And the problems were just huge and overwhelming, and I didn't know where to start. I knew that things were really bad, but I had no idea. I'd never done any activism. I didn't know anything about anything. And so I thought, okay, for every dollar I spend on gas, and I wasn't paying enough for gas. What I mean by that is that the ecological and social expenses of gas are much greater. So for every dollar I spent on gas, I was going to give a dollar to an environmental organization, a local environmental organization, as opposed to a large-scale one. But I didn't have any money, and so what I did is I started paying myself $5 an hour to do activism. And I would, write letters to the editor. I would start participating in protests. I did some anti-fur demos and some anti-circus demos. You know, I didn't know anything about circuses except that they're bad for animals. And so, you know, I didn't even have to make a sign. I just showed up, and they gave me a sign. I stood there, and somebody was like, "So what's wrong with circuses?" And I said, "I don't know. Ask the guy next to me." Because, I mean, I didn't let my ignorance get in the way. I knew they're bad, so I'm going to do something. And I participated in protests outside of the Fairchild Air Force Base in Spokane. All sorts of things. Gay Pride. I did one of those marches. And then from there, I got started into doing timber sale appeals. And by then, I was having so much fun with the activism that I stopped keeping track because, you know, I could have bought, you know, 1,000 gallons of gas with them because I was so far ahead because I was having so much fun. And so the point is that this got me off my behind and got me started doing something. And that's why I think it was the best decision I ever made. And it's something anybody can do, that if you, you know, it's a way you can start because it's really hard to start. The problems are so huge. What do I do? Well, do something. And if you don't like it, then do something else. If you don't like that, then do something else. And if you like that, then keep doing it.
Yeah, great suggestion.
I just want to acknowledge his courage in doing that. That, you know, he did that knowing full well that he could pay a serious personal price. And so, you know, in all my other sort of wandering about that, I skipped over that. And I think that's absolutely crucial to acknowledge this explicitly.
Yeah, he's brave. Well, thanks. If something Derek said has sparked a question for you, email it to me at events@orionmagazine.org. Or you could use the online chat box, but please keep it as brief as you can. Email is best. The address, again, is events@orionmagazine.org. To learn more about Derek, visit his website, derekjensen.org, to connect with his other writings or to see where he's appearing next. You can also watch the film inspired by and featuring Derek, called End Civ, in its entirety online now, and it's at endciv.com. It's great. If anyone would like a copy of his latest book, Deep Green Resistance, or his new book, Dreams, which is coming out next month, Derek's publisher, Seven Stories Press, has offered a copy of one or the other to two folks on the phone with us tonight. So send an email to events@orionmagazine.org with the subject line, Free Book. You'll be entered to win. The winner of Dreams will have to wait until June when the book is actually released, of course. But check back at orionmagazine.org/community later tomorrow to download the full audio recording of this if you want to hear it again. And while there, remember you can join the discussion about principled activism. Again, that's orionmagazine.org/community. Please do leave a comment on this topic. But let's get to your many questions because there are many, many here. Now, Nate has written in, he says, Derek, where do you see the resistance movement within the USA and anywhere, really, at this moment in time? There's been a real lack of physical resistance, and we've not made much progress. Would you agree that we need some more people willing to do the underground side of things as opposed to the above-ground work? I think we need it all, but I feel there is too much of one and not nearly enough of the other.
Well, I agree with a lot of the question, except I don't believe there's too much of one. I don't think you can ever have too much of one. I do think there's not enough of the other. But I think we need to remember that even in the IRA, only 2% of the people ever picked up weapons, that most of the work is above-ground work, and most of the work will always be above-ground work, which can include vociferous support for underground work and should include vociferous support for underground work. I think what's really true is that there is no resistance in this country. There is none. There is some loyal opposition is pretty much the best we've got. And Gayle Dines talks about this in terms of there not being a left in this country, if you define left by being anti-capitalist. You know, one of the things, I was a little right-winger in my teens and earlier years, and in the 1970s, it was a great source of amusement to me that the Soviet Union called itself a democracy, but that something like 98% of the Politburo were Communist Party members. Well, that's pretty funny until we realize that, you know, what percentage of the House of Representatives and Senate are Capitalist Party members? And frankly, 90% of the environmental intelligentsia are pro-capitalist. They'll never speak out against capitalism. And so we don't have a serious resistance movement, even intellectually, for the most part in this country. We've got a few, you know, Chris Hedges speaks out against capitalism, and there are some younger people who are doing some great anti-capitalist work. I'm thinking of Thomas Lindsay, Darja Mail. And so we need to really begin with an anti-capitalist, an anti-civ perspective, but, you know, let's start with anti-capitalist. And because capitalism is destroying the planet, is chewing it up. And so basically what we do have is a loyal opposition. We don't have a resistance. And we have basically people whose tactics consist primarily of petitioning the king to do something that the king will never do because it's not in the king or the capitalist's best interest. And we don't have a fundamental understanding of what has been known to oppress peoples forever. You know, Frederick Douglass, power concedes nothing without demand. And we don't have the fundamental understanding that Gene Sharp has of we need to understand. It's like I wrote an essay about this for Orion a while back about how whenever I go to any of these sort of green events, I'm not talking about one of my own talks or something, but whenever I go to some sort of green festival or something, I always end up really depressed because I went to Bioneers one time and I was the only person there who was talking about power or psychopathology. And I don't understand how you can talk about social change without talking about power, because those in power rule by force, and the only thing they understand is force, which doesn't have to be violent and doesn't have to be underground. But they don't understand. They're not going to go, oh, my gosh, you're right, let's change. I mean, the famous bus boycotts, they were based on not changing the hearts and minds of those in power, but instead using economic force to bring the bus companies to their knees. And apartheid didn't end because those who were running it suddenly decided that they had hearts. Instead, it was because they were brought to their knees. And what was it, last fall, the French were able to almost bring the French economy to its knees by massive strikes. And if we had the numbers, then we could shut down industrial culture tomorrow. But I don't believe we have the numbers, which means we have to start thinking about other tactics. And we have to start, I mean, the real question I always ask is, so if polar bears could take on human manifestation, how would they act? Would they write a letter to, would they put an online petition, you know, begging Congress to do some cap and trade? What would, if Delta smelt, a formerly extremely common smelt in the Sacramento River Delta, if they could take on human manifestation, how long would the pumps last on the Sacramento River? The position of being a loyal opposition is a position of extreme privilege. And if subsistence farmers in India, if you could hear how they want to stop global warming, do you think they would want to stop it through means that protect capitalism? See, here's one of the deals, is that all the solutions to global warming that are put forward in the mainstream are, they take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is that which must conform to industrial capitalism. And that's insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality, because without a natural world, you don't have any social system at all. And what's more, like I said, it's a position of extreme privilege, because this is coming from the beneficiaries of industrial capitalism. And do you think that the victims of industrial capitalism, I'm talking about the hammerhead sharks, I'm talking about the pencil fish, I'm talking about the goblin sharks, I'm talking about the salmon, I'm talking about traditional indigenous people living in the Amazon, do they, would their solutions to global warming, I mean, it's like I asked a child, a seven-year-old, how do you stop global warming caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas? And the child said, he stopped burning oil and gas. And how this relates to the question of the underground is that I don't really care whether the actions are above ground or below ground. What I care about is living in a world that's not murdered. And we need to put our lives and our bodies in between the oil economy and the planet. And if there are still humans 100 years from now, this is a line that my friend Lee Arkey says all the time, if there are humans 100 years from now, they're going to wonder what the fuck was wrong with us that we didn't fight like hell when the world was going down. And what we need is serious, organized political resistance, by which I don't mean loyal opposition, but I mean a resistance that cares more about salmon than it does capitalism, and that cares more, that is explicitly aimed toward protecting the Kootenai sturgeon, Selkirk caribou, bull trout, black tern, from this culture, and will do whatever it takes. And we're only talking about life on the planet. So do we need an underground resistance? Yes. Do we need above ground resistance? Yes. Do we need it all? Yes. And we need to get really serious about it. I was just this week, Sunday night, Monday night, I don't remember, but it blurs in when I'm on tour. I flew into Moline, Illinois, and I got in about 1 o'clock in the morning. My flights were all late. And I'm standing out in front of the airport waiting for my shuttle, for the shuttle to my hotel, and I'm looking around, and it's about 70, 71 degrees. I'm looking around, and something's bothering me. I can't figure out what it is. And finally, I realize I don't see a single moth. There's not a single moth flying around these. And have you noticed that if you don't see bug splats on windshields nearly as much anymore? Bugs are getting hammered. I was just outside a little while ago, and I keep a little diary of of who I see, what, and when, and how much, just really informally. And 3 and 4 years ago, 2 years ago even, there would be dragonflies in the sky at this time of year, so many that there would be literally 100 or 200 dragonflies over the pond. I've seen 3 little blue skimmers so far this year. I haven't seen any. I know I saw one big dragonfly. That's it. 4 years ago, I was seeing 5 newts, 6 newts at a time, and I've seen 2 newts all year. Even banana slugs are collapsing. So what we need to do is to transfer our loyalty away from this wretched system. It's like, you know, Lester Brown has Plan D 7.0 or whatever to save civilization. But it's civilization that's killing the planet. That's like Plan B 7.0 to save Ted Bundy. You know, my loyalty is not to civilization. My loyalty is to the oysters who are disappearing around the world. And my loyalty is to the bats who are disappearing and to the migratory songbirds. And I say this not with any sort of cavalier attitude. I have Crohn's disease, and I'm reliant on high-tech medicines for my life. And when the grid crashes, I'm dead in 6 months. But my life is not more important than the health of the land base. And part of the problem is the belief that any human life is more important than the land base, including my own. But the health of the land is everything. Those who come after are not going to care about whether we had some groovy plan to do this or that, and they're not going to care about how we voted. They're not going to care about whether we recycled. They're not going to care even how hard we tried. What they're going to care about is whether they can breathe the air and drink the water. That's the bottom line. The health of the land is primary. And so, yes, we need a serious resistance movement, and this resistance movement needs to take every form.
Well, Andrew had written in a good follow-up question with more nuts and bolts, and maybe you have the answer or maybe not, but he says, what can people working on above-ground activities do to support people working on underground activities without endangering the others? What can we learn about this in the past or in the current resistance movements?
Well, those are both great questions so far, and I'm really happy for them. And for this one, and I hate to make this too obvious of a plug, but we talk about this extensively in the book Deep Green Resistance by Eric McBailey, Eric Keith, and I. And we talk extensively about things like security culture, where if you're above ground, one of the reasons I feel pretty comfortable saying all these things is because there needs to be a firewall between above ground and below ground activities. And it is part of one's job as being in the above ground. I shouldn't say I feel comfortable. One of the reasons I do is because if you're in the above ground, part of your job is to attract attention to yourself. But you shouldn't have any contact with the below ground. There should be an absolute firewall between above ground and below ground activities. I was doing a talk one time. This guy came up to me after the talk and shook my hand, and I pulled my hand away, and there's a little piece of paper in it, and it said, after the talk, let's go mess some stuff up in the parking lot. And I was just laughing because, you know, that's just so ridiculous that if you're above ground, your job is to articulate the critique and to support whatever effective actions you can. And if your job is in the underground, then it's like a friend of mine always said that if you're going to be a revolutionary, you shouldn't look like one. And this person wears a suit and tie every day. And I was talking to one of the Shaq 7. It was so funny. Talking about a Shaq 7, and he was saying that years before he was sent to prison for that, he was arrested for doing some civil disobedience. And he was in there, you know, preaching about how we need to have a revolution against the system, and we need to be, you know, he's talking about anti-civ stuff and talking about anti-corporate stuff, how we need to have a serious resistance movement. And then one of the social prisoners in there said, so you want to have a real serious resistance movement? And he said, yeah. He said, okay, today you did civil disobedience and you got arrested, right? You stood there and got arrested? He said, yeah. And he said, if it's a serious resistance movement, don't you want to not get caught? And he thought that was pretty funny. So the point is that, yes, we need to study historical resistance movements and what they did right, what they did wrong. the Black Panthers talk about something that they did wrong, and they say this explicitly, that one of the things they did wrong was they made bunkers. And you can't, any resistance movement can't really defend a space. That violates some really fundamental principles of guerrilla warfare. You can't, oh, this is really funny. Eric talks about this a lot, that in the resistance movements in World War II, they frequently, the underground resistance groups who were in contact with the Allies would always ask for field artillery. And that's hilarious because if they got field artillery, they would get stopped, you know, because they have to stay mobile, and you can't be mobile with artillery. So this is something that's happened a lot. Another thing that's happened with resistance movements, it's very interesting, and once again, Eric talks about this a lot, that they will begin with, there are some pretty straightforward trajectories you can see, or growth patterns you can see resistance movements go through. Like in France, as soon as the Germans invaded, you know, the French were saying that we will resist through our spirituality, and we will, one of the things they actually said was that the elegance of Parisian women would be a form of resistance against the Germans. And when that didn't actually work, then they would move on to, you know, either forms of civil disobedience, except that's more difficult than an openly repressive regime like the Nazis, or to sabotage and so on. But at first they were, you know, they tried this sort of spiritual and artistic means that that are common to every young resistance movement. Well, another thing I want to mention, just while we're talking, as long as I'm mentioning the Deep Green Resistance book, I also want to mention that if people want to learn more about that particular subject, they can go to deepgreenresistance.org, where we have more information about that.
Great. Chuck says, Derek, I find your latest column very intriguing. In today's society, the vast majority of people obtain info about the world via the television, internet, newspapers, all of which seem to parrot the same worldview and cosmology that led us to where we are. Thus, if the underlying cosmology and worldview that leads to destructive behavior is constantly reinforced by the powers that be, what chances are there that people will alter that behavior?
Well, that's a great point and a really problematical one. I think a lot about what Henry Adams said maybe 110 years ago. He said, the press is a hired agent set up for no other reason than to tell lies where the interests are concerned. The press is a hired agent of a money system set up for no, the press is a hired agent of a money system set up for no other reason than to tell lies where the interests are concerned. And that's, you know, I stopped getting quite so outraged at what the corporate press does all the time because that's their job. I mean, their job is to lie. And it still bothers me. It still makes me really mad. But it stopped, you know, getting my bowels in an uproar. And we need to combat that through telling the truth as much and as clearly as we can. I just gave a talk a few weeks ago in Portland, and the topic was art as a combat discipline. I think that we need to tell different stories. That's part of what needs to happen. And we need to I find it really disturbing that there are so many songs about, like, romantic love, but how many songs of resistance do we really hear? And there are songs of resistance out there, but we need more. And we need, humans are storytelling creatures. We're social creatures. We learn, we are socialized through stories. And we do need to tell different stories. And we do need to have, like, I got one friend who is heading off to, I don't remember the name of the school, but it's some famous philosophical school in Switzerland because he wants to shake up the European philosophical tradition and bring some biocentrism into it. And I think that's really important. That's one of the things. That's why I don't like being pegged as a violence guy, because, sure, those in power don't give up willingly, but we need it all, including people changing philosophies. You know, in the book Dreams, one of the things I talk about is I attack Richard Dawkins, whom I just can't stand. And he has this line where he says, science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. And my point in bringing that up is that there's a sense in which it's true. You know, you flip on a light switch and it works, and that's because of science and technology and that way of looking at the world. But there's a part in which there's a very, very, very deep lie, and that's he has made our epistemology, he's defined our epistemology. Epistemology is how we know something is true, how we know something is right, real. He's defined this culture's epistemology as being based on domination, on the ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command. But think about this. Let's say you and I are in the same room, and let's say I pull a gun out, and I point the gun at you, and I say, you, jump through that hoop right now, and you jump through it. What do you know? I'm a genius because I predicted you would jump through that hoop, and I caused you to do it. But if I put a gun on you, doesn't that mask other forms of truth and, in fact, destroy other forms of truth? And there are other truths that are destroyed by that truth. And my point in bringing all this up is that that's how deep this culture's urge to dominate goes. It's in the epistemology itself, which is really about as close as you can get to the center of knowledge. And, wow, in all this, I've lost the question. What was the question again?
Is there an underlying cosmology is so reinforced? What's the chance that we're going to be able to alter this behavior?
Well, on one level, there's not much chance. But on another level, all you have to do is go outside because pay attention. You know, the moths are telling you, and the frogs are telling you, and your body's telling you. And the only good thing we have on our side in that way is that lies are very expensive to maintain, and they have to be reinforced constantly. And honestly, I don't think there's much chance. But what we can do is we can insist on the truth and speak the truth as forcefully as we can at every opportunity that we can. And that will help give other people the courage to do that too. And that's one of the ways a resistance movement gets formed. I still remember when I was about 27, I was in a library, and this book jumped off the shelf at me. It was Neil Everdon's The Natural Alien. And I'd never read a book before that didn't take the utilitarian worldview as a given. And I remember standing there in the library and feeling like this huge weight went off my shoulders because I suddenly realized in that moment, I'm not crazy. This culture is crazy because it always seemed crazy that they try to put a monetary value on every living being. And I'd never read anybody. Now I know there's a whole literature that is different, but I had no idea until that point. That introduced me to it. So, you know, it doesn't take many truth tellings to help people understand start to see their way through the lies.
Now, another Derek is on the line with us right now. He writes in from Albuquerque. He says, I am part of a collective that is in solidarity with the Diné or Navajo resistors on big mountain called the Black Mesa Indigenous Support. I was wondering if you could talk about your solidarity work with other Native activists. What does non-Native solidarity work look like for you?
Well, that's another great question. And I recently was up at University of Victoria. I was brought there by the Indigenous Governance Council. And I went to my friend Waz's. She brought me to her graduate level class. And it was pretty interesting because they pretty much grilled me. And they'd read Endgame, but they were still like, one of the questions they asked is, so if you're an ally to indigenous people, to whom are you an ally? What does that mean? And I said, honestly, I don't know because, you know, am I an ally to the Hopi Tribal Council that's last I heard was all Mormon? You know, I've talked to indigenous peoples who don't trust any tribal council in the U.S. And so I don't want to essentialize indigenous people by saying I'm an ally to indigenous people because they're just as heterogeneous as anybody else. And what I do know is that I try to be really – I have made some really good allies within indigenous communities. And in great measure, that's because I've been doing my job as a white person to try to deconstruct white settler society and to correct the injustices I see here. And in so doing, we find ourselves working in alliance. And that is what has worked for me. I do know that some people, like doing that support at Black Mesa, that's a whole different situation where you're coming in to specifically do support. And probably, I'm guessing that the questioner could answer this question much better than I in terms of that part of it, because that is specifically going in to do that particular form of support. And there are, I'm sure, various matters of etiquette and procedure that I would be entirely unaware of. But for myself, once again, it's simply that I try to, it's like my book Culture Make Believe was an attempt to write about racism and misogyny from the perspective of a white person and a male, and to not attempt to talk about that from an African American perspective, but instead say, this is what it's like from the inside, and it looks pretty rotten.
Here's someone who says, he's got a comment and a question about NCIV. He says, I believe that we should start civilization because we don't have a true civilization now. I see humans as naturally destructive for the planet and the creatures on it. I think by using sound technology, we can leave a smaller footprint than hunter-gatherers. Do you?
No. The Tala lived here for 12,500 years, and they didn't destroy the place when the Europeans arrived here. And this is according to the myths of science. If you believe the myths of science, they lived here for 12,500 years. If you believe the myths of the Talawa, they lived here since the beginning of time. And that's simply true. And you can't realistically argue that they didn't live here for at least 12,500 years. And when the Europeans arrived, even the early European accounts were that it was a paradise. And runs of salmon so thick that people were afraid to get in the water, put their boats in the water for fear they would capsize. Runs of salmon that you could hear for miles before you would see them. And it's only been 150 years, and this place is trashed. And so I don't believe that humans are inherently destructive because the Talawa lives here for 12,500 years. And it's not just the Talawa. The Yurok lived just down the coast. And there's the Wiat and the Hupa, but they had fundamentally different ways of living. It wasn't, they didn't not destroy the place because they were too stupid to invent backhoes. They didn't destroy the place because their technologies were entirely different. They would, for example, sing songs of welcoming to the salmon. That was a form of technology, instead of making machines. Lewis Mumford has this great distinction between authoritarian and democratic technics. And a technic is a social structure that gives rise to and surrounds and emerges from a specific piece of technology. And an authoritarian technic would be one that requires top-down hierarchy. And a democratic technic is one that anyone can do. And a great example of an authoritarian technic would be nuclear energy, that it requires large-scale social organization and requires top-down planning and requires huge organizations to do. An example of one that we would not think is an authoritarian technic, but it is solar photovoltaics. You know, it's all groovy if we could all be independent of the power grid, but I can't make a photovoltaic in my backyard. And that's pretty much the distinction, is whether I need to have that larger scale organization to make it. So a great example of a democratic technic would be pottery. Another great contrast would be guns versus bows and arrows or spears. I could make a spear. It's a democratic technic. Anybody can make a spear. Our spears might not be very good, but we can make them, and I'm not saying it doesn't take skill. I'm not saying it doesn't take tradition to really learn how to do it, but anybody can make a spear. On the other hand, unless you have access to a bat cave, you can't make gunpowder, which means you're reliant upon a distant entity for it. So it's inherently authoritarian, inherently forces you to be reliant on someone else. So, I don't think humans are inherently destructive, because if they were, then They would have, humans have been on the planet living as hunter-gatherers for a long, long time. And for 98% of our existence, we weren't particularly destructive. And so I don't agree with that. And honestly, my feeling on if somebody does believe that humans are inherently destructive, and if they care about life on the Earth, then what they should do is make a big virus that's going to wipe out humans because humans are inherently destructive. And you can't fight biology. But I don't believe that humans are inherently destructive. The next part about technology, I think I've sort of covered that. And so far as people living with high technology that has less impact than a hunter-gatherer, you know, they say that one sign of intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. Well, let's lay out the pattern and see if we can recognize it. Let's see if we can recognize this pattern in less than 6,000 years. That when people think of Iraq, is the first thing they think of cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touches the ground? The first written myth of this culture, one of the first written myths, was Gilgamesh deforesting the plains and hillsides of Iraq. And Saudi Arabia was an oak savanna, and Near East was heavily forested, Greece was heavily forested. I mean, this culture has had 6,000 years to prove whether it can be sustainable or not, and it's that 6,000-year history does not give one much hope for optimism. And so far as technology and high technologies, you know, science has been given 300 years to prove itself. And, I mean, we have to ask, is the world a better place because of science? You know, I don't think that it would be easy to make that case at all, because if it weren't for science, there wouldn't be more plastic than phytoplankton in the oceans. And if it weren't for science, there wouldn't be globalization. There wouldn't be nuclear waste dumps. There's, you know, on and on and on. That has science made the world a better place? Sure, it's made life easier for some of us, but has it made the world a better place? So I don't see any real evidence of that. And I think once again that hammerhead sharks have backed me up on this one.
Rebecca has written in, and I think she's quoting you here. She says, "A big distinction is between people who do something and people who do nothing." Unquote. What if those who are apathetic or doing nothing are trauma victims on some level? People self-medicating with consumption. Apathy is perhaps one response to trauma. People need tending and healing, and in fact, empathy. Do you see a place for this in activism?
Sure. I think that it's really important for women to work on rape crisis hotlines. And I have a friend who does wildlife rehabilitation work, and I think that's really important. There's a need for all of that. I think that that's one, you know, if we could break activism down into multiple forms, you know, one form would be defensive activism. This is people filing timber sales, people trying to, you know, tree sits for that matter, trying to defend a particular place or particular creature, particular person, particular set of people. Another would be legal, you know, people working within the legal system, lawyers. You know, some of my heroes are attorneys who do great work for women, for the natural world, for trees. Another would be doing sort of spiritual work. Another would be artistic work. Another would be taking the offensive, which is, you know, going after the corporations, whether, you know, going back to Nate's question, whether it's above ground, below ground, whatever, going after the perpetrators of abuse, going after the perpetrators of global abuse. So I think we need all of those. And the important question is whether these people who are doing the work on people's souls or the work on helping people to recover from trauma, the question is whether they see that as an end in itself or whether they see that consciously. And they take that on consciously as part of a resistance. And there's a huge distinction between trying to save us for our own self and trying to save us and help us become better warriors. You know, I have some friends who think that therapy is always bad, but I know that, you know, I was in therapy for years, and it was actually really helpful in making me more effective as a writer and as an activist. It made me less fearful and more proactive, and that's a good thing for everybody. So if it can help us become better people, by which I mean a person as defined as the sum of their relationships and more. By relationships, I mean the relationship with non-humans as well. And if it, you know, it's kind of like I've had these discussions with some very highly politically active Buddhists. You know, in Endgame, there are parts of Buddhism that I really attack. And I was having this discussion actually just a couple weeks ago, I was talking to a Buddhist who's very, very engaged, and I was saying that my attacks on the sort of disengaged Buddhism, it was like years ago, I read this guy in this one interview, he said, what I do for anti-war work is I chop wood and I carry water. And that is just such crap that that's not actually activism, that's chopping wood and carrying water, and it doesn't actually help anybody but you. And my perception on this, or my perspective on this, is that any spirituality that doesn't cause you to actively dismantle oppressive systems and to actively dismantle injustice is no spirituality at all. And I would say any therapeutic work that ultimately does not help to dismantle systems of oppressive justice can be palliative. And we can use the word palliative as long as we're clear that it is only palliative. And palliation is a very important thing sometimes, but it's only palliative. I mean, nobody who's working on a rape crisis hotline believes that their work itself is going to stop rape. What it's going to do is to help the women who are raped, and that's a great and important thing to do. But in addition, we also need to proactively work to stop rape. So the only reason I'm going on and on about this is that over the years, I've encountered so many people who believe that all we need to do is that sort of personal change. And the personal change is very important, personal healing is very important, but what is also necessary is organized political resistance.
Well, we ought to begin wrapping up now. But do you have like a final thought or you know some kind of summarizing feeling from this conversation tonight, Derek, to share?
Oh, gosh. I just want to actually thank all the questioners for the really great questions. And I would like to also take the opportunity to thank you for setting it up. I know this has to be a lot of work on your part, and also I noticed you know, I've been looking at the pictures. You did a great job of assembling all that. So I just want to send some gratitude your way as well.
No trouble at all. It's a pleasure. Events like this are made possible by subscriptions to Orion Magazine and by your donations. So please go to orionmagazine.org/donate to support our efforts to bring people together for conversations like tonight. And again, if you make a gift between now and Memorial Day, it'll be matched dollar for dollar by a group of generous Orion donors as part of our Spring Challenge campaign. But check back at orionmagazine.org/community later on tomorrow for the audio recording. While there, you can also connect with other important topics like today's and leave a comment about principled activism. I'd love to hear your thoughts there. Our next live event is June 16th on connecting both kids and adults more meaningfully with nature, with top experts on the issue, including Richard Liu, Camilla Rockwell, and David Sobel. Registration info for that event will be posted soon at orionmagazine.org/news, so check back there for details. But mostly I just want to say thanks so much, Derek, for joining us tonight, sharing your time, and sharing your worldview in the pages of Orion. It's really great. And thanks to everyone for sharing your time with us today.
So thanks. And can I have one final statement here?
Absolutely.
Okay. So I guess the final statement is I'll see you on the barricades, unless, of course, you're in the underground, in which case I won't see you at all.
This is Eric Hoppner of Orion Magazine signing off. Goodbye, all. Thanks very much. Thank you.